Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
All right. We're wrapping up another weekend, man. Another weekend coming and gone. Crazy. Time is flying by. I can't believe how close we are now to the Jericho cruise. A couple weeks out? And people, there are still some seats and or cabins available for the Jericho cruise if you're interested in joining us. Tim and I will be on there. They've got some of the guys from Impractical Jokers. They've got some professional wrestlers. They've got some professional rock musicians, comedians, and more. This is going to be the getaway of the year. Plus, did I mention we're going to be going right through the Bermuda Triangle, Tim?
Oh,
right,
yes.
Through the Bermuda Triangle right around Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
How cool is that?
Very.
Tim and I will be on board. We're going to be doing some paranormal hijinks, and we're going to try to do an intention experiment to see if we can communicate with UFOs or USOs while we're out in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. So there's a lot of cool stuff going on. I hope you guys will check it out. You can get information on that and all the other things that I'll be a part of, including the Paracon in the North Woods that's going to be taking place. I think it's Friday, November 2nd, and Saturday, November 3rd in Green Bay at the Mohican Casino and Resort. It is going to be huge. And they've got some great guests. Grant Wilson will be on hand. I'll be the MC for the weekend. Jeff Belanger, Linda Godfrey, Allison Jornland, Chad Lewis, Dave Olson, Troy Hudson. Those are just a few of the names that will be on site. And we'd love for you guys to join us and get out there and have a good time. There's other conventions and things coming up throughout the year. And you can find all the information at darknessradio.com. Click on that events tab. And that's the best way to find us. All right, Tim, joining us today on the show, we've got a brand new Theater of the Mind coming up a little bit later on in the program, but one of our favorite guests, he seems to pop in every couple of years and was just with us a little bit, I think around January of this year with his Haunted Honky Tonks book.
Mm-hmm.
He's back with us now. Matthew Swain is a journalist who currently works as a research writer at Penn State, and he's worked as a reporter and as a music reviewer for several newspapers and online outlets. His new book, Haunted World War II, Soldiers, Spirits, Ghost Planes, and Strange Synchronicities. He walks you through strange battlefields in Europe, invasion sites in the South Pacific, and other places where spirits of soldiers, sailors, and civilians seem to be returning again and again to recreate their last moments. The book is coming out, I believe it's October 8th. Is that right, Matt?
Yes, I think it's October 8th or 9th.
Through Llewellyn. So it's great to have you back with us, Matthew. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Let's dive in. You know, having a grandfather who, and your grandfather was in World War II as well, right, Tim?
Yep, two tours.
Yep, and my grandfather was in World War II as a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne, a sergeant, and hearing the stories and the tales and having been able to go to places like England and Germany over the last few years to see these sites and locations for myself where these places took, battles took place, and being out in Pearl Harbor and standing over the USS Arizona, there are definitely places where you can't deny feeling a sense of energy. And something, and I've mentioned it on the show before, Matt, but I went to the USS Arizona, I think about 21 years ago, and stood over the Arizona, and I just began weeping at one point, and I looked around, there was five other guys on there, none of us knew each other, everybody's bawling like babies, standing on there, and it was just this overwhelming sense of sadness that I can't even begin to comprehend. I mean, I had no connection to this, I didn't know these people, But there is this sense of loss. You can feel it. It's palpable. It's in the air when you go to that location and some of these other sites.
Yeah, and I think you sort of touched on a part that was difficult for me to write this book because, you know, on one hand, I want to tell these stories. On the other hand, there's a, you know, there's solemnness, a solemnity about these places. They're really, some of them are literally graveyards. So I, you know, my approach to this was, and also, you know, just on the side, I have a minor in history, and I have a real love of history, and I actually have a real love for military history. I'm more of a kind of a Civil War buff, you know, I study it, and I wanted to respect the history too. And sometimes ghost stories don't tell the full story, the full history. So my approach was trying to, again, kind of thread the needle. So the book should be so that it doesn't mean disrespect at all. But I think from this collection of stories that I brought together for this book, I really understand the sacredness of this and the energy that these places give off. It can't be a coincidence that just about every place I looked into had some type of supernatural, spiritual activity around it. So that's really the kind of frame of how I approach the book.
I understand what you're talking about, kind of wanting to make sure that you don't step on kind of sacred ground when you're doing this and talking about some of these places or you know, feeling like you're making light. Going out and traveling the world and having had a chance to visit some sites in England and Germany, you know, where the war was so prevalent, it's pretty remarkable. I know they took us to one of the stadiums where Adolf Hitler gave this huge speech and dissertation, and they've got photographs and the dais is there and everything is still as it is, and you have access to it. And
right.
It's very surreal to know I'm standing in the exact spot that Adolf Hitler stood as he said these words that set about wheels in motion that cost millions of lives across the world. And even though you're in a different time and a different era, it's impactful because you realize that you're still sharing that exact space.
Absolutely.
Where something unbelievable took place. And it's not, I felt almost sick to my stomach, Matt, when I was standing there, because I felt like, this isn't a sense of glee, but this is a sense of just kind of, you know, you're here, oh my God, this is a place where this isn't like, oh yeah, he drove by in a car. He stood in the spot talking to people, and you could almost imagine the sea of people around you, and you look over and you see the pictures of what it looked like, and there's not much difference. I mean, it's a raceway now, but you can see where they stood. You can see the pictures and the looks on their faces and the angles of him speaking and how they were enthralled. And it's compelling. It's amazing history to that it's still there, that it's still preserved, and that we can walk in these places. And I know you know, you can visit Auschwitz and you can visit some of these locations that, you know, are so dark in history and rich in history. And it's in one sense, you know, I love books like yours, and I love when somebody takes the history and they're able to make it accessible to people who may not be as fascinated by military history and history in general. And you give it a paranormal slant. So it's a spoonful of sugar making the really hard stuff go down. But right. here's what the history is of this location and the atrocities. And here's what's happened to remind us that this should never happen again. And that's really impactful. So I appreciate that guys like you do these historic books and do it with respect and admiration for the people that lost their lives and allowing their story to be told as well.
Well, I really appreciate that. I had so many great professors, so many great history professors, and I've discussed some of this with some historians. And, you know, there's a debate back and forth about, for instance, in Gettysburg, where there's almost a cottage industry around the ghost tours. And my point that I like to say is there's probably hundreds of maybe thousands of people who normally would have never visited that battlefield at all, wouldn't have learned anything without that draw. And so I think hopefully what this book does is maybe brings people in for these ghost stories, but then they decide to stick around to learn more, because there's much, much more to learn. I barely, you know, I can't really in a paragraph or two paragraph talk about the sacrifices on Normandy or the Ardennes, or, you know, you brought up about Auschwitz, and I worked with a ghost hunter for this book. His name's Tom Padal, and he lives in Germany, and he gave me a lot of good details of some of the haunted areas that he visited, like the Ardennes forest, where the Battle of the Bulge took place. But he told me one place he will not investigate, will not talk about, is Auschwitz and some of the concentration camps. He said he knows that he's heard other people tell him ghost stories about those places, but he will not investigate. He will not divulge any of that. And I respected that in this book, too, because I left all of that out, but besides a few mentions where I really felt like I needed to address something.
Right. And you know, when we did our tour of Germany and Prague, at first, you know, they'd offered some of these concentration camp sites and historic locations. And I really thought, you know what, if this was a history tour, I'd say yes. But knowing that we're on a paranormal tour, I just thought that's a little too ghoulish. And if people want to come in a little early and go check these sites out on their own, they can. But I didn't want to, you know, and it's a strange line. Why do we draw it that it's okay to go here where an atrocity took place or death took place, but not here? And it's hard to explain. Just like, you know, I can't think of any self-respecting investigator that would want to go to the site of 9/11 and investigate there and be a part of that. But, you know, I mean, there's so much of the history out there. Now, when you started, you know, you got the germ to do this book and look at the paranormal aspects, were you surprised by the amount of places that claim activity here 70, 80 years later?
Yeah, I really was. And you know, I will be completely transparent. When I wrote a couple books about music and the supernatural, and I feel real affinity for music history. So I was looking for a new project. And because I'm more of a Civil War buff, I thought I would look into, you know, another ghost book about the Civil War. But I think if you would look at any, you know, bookshelf there, I really didn't feel like I could add anything to that, those collections. So I just kind of came up with this idea. I would look for World War II stories. And as you mentioned, you know, I visited the USS Yorktown. I visited the USS North Carolina. I've been to some of those sites in the States, and I didn't have any paranormal experiences per se, but just the vibe when you're on those places, when you're looking at the pictures of these just basically kids that are, you know, taking on the world as sailors and as Marines, you just come away with this, you just have this overwhelming feeling that something supernatural, something could happen. These are, as I like to say, consciousness raising activities. And that's right. What I think history is to me. So, you know, I had this idea that there would be some ghost stories. And of course, I think I've heard of some before. I knew that there would be a nucleus of stories. But what happens is, as you're starting to write these, really compiling these stories and starting to write them, you really sort of have this fear that you're going to get to like 15,000 words and drop off a cliff. And so, you know, I just didn't want this to be a dud. But what I found that I think is unique in haunted history is that World War II ghost stories don't just happen in the United States. They happen across the world. It's a global conflict. You will have ghost stories on sea and on land. And I think totally unique for this type of thing is that there are actually ghosts in the sky. So I was more fascinated by how all of these different aspects were at play when I wrote this. So the structure of my book changed pretty rapidly from just being about ghosts of battlefields, which is ideally what I was going after, to, you know, ghost planes. And then I really love this kind of Freudian side of World War II. So I dove into synchronicities and signs. And then I wanted to look at what I found on the side as I was investigating some of these ghost stories is the occult threads that find their way into these stories. And
right.
So I looked into that too. And you think of World War II as a real spiritual battle. And so I think maybe I knew that on a intellectual level, but I never really processed it deeply because there were a lot of spiritual occult ideas that were driving some of these philosophies.
I've got to say, I did an interview earlier this year on Midnight in the Desert with Barbara Carlin. And I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she alleges to be the reincarnation of Anne Frank.
Oh,
and her story is very compelling, Matt. I mean, it's extremely compelling. And to the point when she actually went with her family to the site and they were close by and her father said, well, let's take a cab. And she said, we don't need a cab, Dad. It's right around the corner. Having never been there in her life as this young girl, they walked around and she took them right to the place where Anna Frank and her family had hidden. And she had two really kind of interesting things happen when she went in. When she went up and saw the area, she saw a ghosted image of her room as it was when she was there. She said, oh, look, they've kept my pictures up. My celebrity pictures, my pictures are still up on the wall. And they're all looking and they're like, Barbara, there's nothing there. And when she turned to look at them, she's like, what are you talking about? She turned back. The wall was blank. And they asked one of the curators and the curator said, oh, well, on this wall, Anna Frank kept all these photographs from her movie magazines. And she goes, we just recently took those down because people, A, they were trying to steal them, take them as a souvenir. They were just getting worn. We're going to put them behind plastic and rehang them. So that was pretty striking. And then she got overwhelmed at one point and started going down the stairs by herself. And as she did, she ran into one of the German officers coming up the stairs. And just crumpled and began sobbing. And just that aspect of it was so compelling to me to listen. This woman has a remarkable story and what a ghost story to have that here she is in the house and she's kind of stepping and straddling two eras of time, right? Her current day and seeing the place where these photographs and where she hid and what was going on. And then to try to leave, to get a breath of fresh air and run into the spirit of one of the agents that found them. I can't even begin to imagine what that must be like. And to hear the kind of stories as you're digging up and going through this, I can't wait to uncover. All right, we're back and we're here to talk about haunted World War II, soldier spirits, ghost planes, and strange synchronicities. I want to save some of the ghosty stories for a little bit later. Mm-hmm. I was intrigued by the occult aspects and the synchronicities. Can you kind of start us off in there and we'll work our way through?
Yeah, sure. So I started getting into this book and then a lot of this information started to come my way and about, you know, the signs and synchronicities of World War II. In other words, there's, you know, Carl Jung has this philosophy of acausal connections where things are seem to be connected, but they can't really be explained through typical causation, through typical time and space. So I looked into a few of those stories, and, you know, probably one of the most famous ones is the Pearl Harbor synchronicity. And I think it's been called the deadly double synchronicity and some things like that. But essentially what happened was there was an ad that came out prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor. And essentially it said, there was dice and the dice had 12 and 7 on it, which meant December 7th. And then there was double X, which is Roman numeral for 20. And a lot of people started speculating that meant that there was the 20th, I think, parallel, which it was basically a location giveaway to Pearl Harbor. So at the time, it was investigated by the Secret Service at the time, the CIA at the time, those agents. They looked into it. They really think that it was just a coincidence. But, you know, if you look at it from a Jungian point of view, why did it crop up at this time? It goes to the level beyond synchronicities. And there was another D-Day synchronicity where several of the code words, I think Mulberry was one of them in Utah and Omaha, all of them referring to beaches. And Mulberry, of course, was a artificial bay that they were going to use, an artificial port, essentially, that they were going to put in Normandy after the invasion. And that really freaked out the Allied service, special services over there, who investigated and apparently came down pretty hard on the crossword puzzle master who came up with it. There was never really any good explanation for it. Again, it was one of these synchronicities. There is another theory that some of the people that worked for the crossword master had been hanging out with American soldiers and American and some other people who may have known some of these code words, who actually slipped them into conversation. They raise up in consciousness, and so they become these. That's how those code words became part of the puzzle. So those are probably two of the more famous synchronicities.
And when you're looking at the occult status of the war, I mean, obviously they played it up quite a bit in the Indiana Jones movies, right? The Nazis' desire to acquire occult artifacts to give them any edge, which a lot of people don't realize that's nothing new in war. They used to carry saints' hands, heads, feet, fingers, all types of things into war at the front of the line, believing that their saint would be the one to deliver them a win.
Right. Yeah.
But now, how much of that was shenanigans of Hollywood, and how much of it was true about Hitler's interest in the occult and wanting to collect these artifacts to try to give him a leg up on the rest of the world?
So that is a really interesting question, especially for me, because when I approached, especially here was my belief, the Nazis were definitely into the occult and the Allied forces were definitely not into the occult. And what I later discovered is as I went this, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of arguments here, but I really feel like the Nazi occult connection is a little overblown. And I feel like it was more of a progression throughout the war. In other words, early on, I think you could make a solid case that the Nazi party had its roots in occult philosophy, like the Thule Society. And that created, gave sort of a overview of a lot of Nazi philosophy. However, over time, especially the idea that I had as Hitler being thoroughly involved in the occult, thoroughly involved in more of the dark aspects of the occult, actually, as I looked into it, I think after this study, I kind of have the idea now that there is no way that Hitler was the ultimate narcissist. I don't think he could conceive of a higher power above himself. So what I tried to piece together was this occult beginnings of the Nazi party, where they started to, you know, with the Thule Society, the basic occult teachings were that there was this master race, the Aryan race, and then there was also talk of real, this kind of power that would give them success. So at the beginning, I think there was this occult connection, but I believe that Hitler really tried to put his foot down on this occult beliefs because it was a belief separate from him and separate from the state. And I think he wanted all focus on that. And of course, there are stories, especially after Rudolf Hess, and he was one of the folks in Hitler's inner circle that unquestionably was involved in these occult organizations. But when Hess left Nazi Germany and flew to England, flew to Scotland, and was captured, and it became a huge public relations fiasco for Hitler. You know, I think Hitler immediately came down on fortune tellers and astrologists and anyone who was dabbling in occult, because he again saw that this was a bad influence on Hess and turned Hess against him. So I came with a different point of view on especially the occult Nazi connection. I think it's there. I think it might be a little overwrought, and it certainly doesn't tell the full story. However, what I was almost stunned to find out was the occult leanings of the Allied forces. In England, there was a group of Wiccans under Gerald Gardner who performed rituals regularly to try to sway the battle away from the Nazis, who were obviously in control early on, to get the Allies to win. There were a few other people like Dion Fortune who sporadically would send out newsletters, you know, beseeching her group to form prayer circles or magic circles at certain times to compound this occult power to go against the Nazis. And then finally, the totally shocking for me, and I think I picked this up through some of Mitch Horowitz's work, is that the New Thought movement, which we would consider positive thinking in the United States, also had their own efforts to kind of sway this supernatural, occult, spiritual power for the Allies against the Nazis. I will add, and I'm going to contradict myself, that if you look at World War II as a spiritual battle, you see that when when I would suggest the occult was at its height for the Nazi Party, that they were in control, and that as the Allies marshaled their own spiritual forces, the tide turned. So maybe that's a coincidence, but I did see that pattern. I'm not sure whether I wrote about it in the book.
The idea that all of these powers were in effect, I mean, it's a pretty crazy part of history as it is. But you look at somebody like Hitler, who had this unbelievable ability to turn people towards unimaginable hate. And it I don't know where you come from, but it kind of feels like there was something dark at play, some demonic force or occult power that this guy had over people to make them follow him so blindly and so willingly and so callously into doing unbelievable crimes and atrocities to fellow human beings. What's your take on that? Or is it, am I not giving credit to just how evil people can really be?
That is an absolutely fantastic question. Something that I thought about a lot, because I was really hoping that I would find this demonic, I don't know that Hitler had a Necronomicon underneath his bed, you know, in the eagle's nest or something like that. But I really didn't find that. I came away from this idea of consciousness as a real power that can be used in a lot of different ways for good and evil. I mean, the totality of the story that I just told you about these occult forces and spiritual forces in war, I think tells an interesting story about how it can be used for good and how it can be used at evil. I mean, unquestionably, I think one of the most frightening things that I've ever seen is a film clip of Hitler preparing to give a speech and then giving the speech. And when you see that he goes up to the podium, he looks a little shaken. He looks nervous. He's shuffling his papers around, but then as he gets into the talk, it is almost like he is possessed by demons. So, you know, my idea was that did he have any of these you know, occult connections. I know there's a story or two about him working with a hypnotist. There's a story about him working with a dramatist, and all of that might play a role. But what I didn't find was the kind of substantial evidence that he was really involved in these types of things. Maybe I wasn't reading the right books. I don't claim to be an expert on that aspect, and it would be neat to and interesting to hear another take on that. But I didn't find that he had this, you know, he had an interest, I think, early on in magic, but I think he somehow found this kind of force in himself. And when you look at other people like Churchill, who had, in my opinion, just as powerful of a way to sway people, to sacrifice just about everything for a good cause, then I think you see the other side of it.
It is pretty remarkable. And I've seen those videos where he gets whipped up as well. Mm. And sometimes the way his eyes roll back, it does make you wonder. I don't know if there's demonic influence or if it is something as simple as he was channeling the intention of hate, pure unadulterated hate. You know, you've got people whipped up. You've got people joining you in a crusade, and you're picking a scab that's very real to them. And to me, I always thought that's crazy. But I've watched. I've been down south in the 60s. You know, I shouldn't say 60s. I was a baby then. But in the 70s, watching people get whipped up over race, mm-hmm. that to me still now at the age of 50 still shocks me. How. Yeah. Normal people that I just were, you know, my cousins were talking to and we were hanging out, and these were just kids from their school. And within seconds, it was like a dark mass cloud moved over them when it turned to race. And I'd never heard such venom and hatred for just the color of people's skin. It was amazing. And if he knew that, it was almost like he was the codex. He knew how to open that part of people, right? And then that intention came to him. Like I said, I don't know. I think he became the full embodiment of hatred.
Yeah, and not to throw out Jung too many times, but there's this idea of collective consciousness. And you really have to wonder when you read about Hitler, when you see some of that footage, you wonder whether, in my opinion, after World War I and after the economic complete collapse in Germany in the third, well, it would have been the Weimar Republic, the anger, the angst, the coming down from such a height where you were, you know, Germany was a world power, to suddenly being, you know, forced to buy bread with money in a grocery basket. The inflation was so bad that I don't know whether Hitler was an aberration of that spirit or a culmination of that spirit. He almost seemed to be able to channel and then exaggerate this fear, anger, hatred, all of that which was going on. And that's what I think propelled the Nazi occult movement more than, you know, maybe the Thule Society or anything like that. I think they were representative of a much deeper, darker spiritual vein going through that time, at that place, at that era.
Matthew Swain, our guest, his book, Haunted, World War II, Soldier Spirits, Ghost Planes, and Strange Synchronicities, will continue after this visit to the Darkhives.
Today's story is ripped from the history books. Daniel Laguerre and the Phantom Fighters. On today's Theater of the Mind. In July 1943, 21-year-old Frenchman Daniel Laguerre was on a day's leave from a German compulsory work service at a labor camp near the Baltic coast of Poland. He would run into a situation that day that was equal measure strange and fascinating. He had taken a shortcut to the nearby town of Exelgraut. As he was making his way through the sand dunes, he could make out a strange object sticking out of the sand ahead of him. In front of it stood a woman with long blonde hair, dressed all in black. She appeared to be trying to free the metallic object. Believing the woman to be one of the German test pilots from the nearby naval base, he thought it wise for him to back away. But before he could do so, she turned her gaze to him. She opened her mouth to speak, and the words came out in a language that Laguerre did not understand. But from how she motioned her arms, he understood she wanted his help to free this, what he believed to be a top-secret German aircraft, from the sand dune. He moved forward and proceeded to pull sand away, handful by handful, casting it behind him, helping to free the object. After 10 minutes or so, the craft was finally free. The woman's tone was one of obvious gratitude. She then touched a silver square button on her belt, which opened a doorway in the object with a whoosh. She motioned that he should stand back before she entered the craft, the doorway sliding shut behind her. The UFO began to rise slowly, glowing slightly, and putting off a harmonious hum before it rocketed upward and vanished into the sky. Only years later, when more and more reports of UFOs were becoming well known, not to mention the exploration of space in the 50s and 60s, did Laguerre begin to believe that the woman was quite probably an extraterrestrial, and that top-secret aircraft was her spaceship. Now, this incident with the aviatrix was not Laguerre's first strange encounter of an apparently extraterrestrial nature. 2 years earlier, in 1941, he witnessed, along with many other people of a French village, an object that appeared to be a large gray cloud, seemingly having a different mass and density to it. But what made it stand out was the fact that there were German fighter planes following the cloud, and that brought the people's attention from all around the village directly to the cloud. The planes then began taking turns engaging the object in a dogfight, attacking it violently. However, when they got within a certain distance from the cloud, their engines would completely shut down. Their planes would sputter, leaving the planes to free fall away. Only when they had fallen a certain distance would their engines spark back to life, allowing the pilots to regain control in a last-minute ditch effort to save their lives. The one-sided aerial battle would play out before the throng of onlookers below, calling out, hooting, hollering, screaming to the skies, in a battle that took place over an hour. When Laguerre attempted to research the incident years later, he would find no mention of it in any newspapers, local or national. He reasoned that, as the German war machine had full control of such mediums during this time, it's perhaps not surprising that no record of this account, aside from his own, exists.
Beyond the Darkness.
We're back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. You can find us here every Saturday and Sunday on Podcast One. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis, and this is Beyond the Darkness. We have been clicking along now. Gosh, is this almost 13 years, Tim? Is that right?
It'll be 13 years in January, yep.
Hoo-wee, boy. Yeah. 13 years.
Yeah.
And it fascinates me how many guests we're able to find that still have amazing stories and history to share, Tim. Mm-hmm. And our guest today is bringing it. Matthew Swain, his new book is Haunted World War II, Soldier Spirits, Ghost Planes, and Strange Synchronicities. It'll be out on October 8th, so make sure you grab a copy. We'll have the link up so you can find that a little bit easier on today's podcast as well. Matthew, let's get into some of the other strange stories. What really kind of blew you away when you were doing this research? I mean, there had to be a couple of stories that just really shocked you.
Yeah, I think easily the one for me that shocked me the most was that German Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, his ghost has been seen. And I would expect especially after all that I've read about the ghost stories of World War II, I thought, well, maybe he was seen in North Africa. It wasn't there. Maybe he was seen in Normandy. And I didn't find any there. Where I did find ghost stories about Rommel was actually in the American South. And that kind of really blew me away.
Wait.
Yep,
what?
Yep, I know. It's kind of fascinating, but it all seems to be, again, this will be controversial for historians, but there was a story, a rumor that prior to World War II, Erwin Rommel and a few other German generals came to the United States on a secret mission to study Civil War battlefields. And the historians around me say that that's not true. There's no evidence. The believers in these ghost stories tell me that it's a secret mission. That's why there's no evidence. And the evidence is these ghost stories. And the one story is that he haunts a graveyard in the U.S. And I can't remember the name of the graveyard, but it's in the South. I think it might be in Virginia. And it's near where the descendants of Patton are buried. And General George Patton had several relatives or ancestors in the Civil War. And they were buried in this graveyard. And apparently Rommel studied that battlefield. And a few people have seen at the grave what looks like a man with a long trench coat about Rommel's size at those graves, looking over the graves in sort of respect. And then there's another inn in the Western Highlands of Virginia, and I think it's called the Highland Inn, and that allegedly is where Rommel stayed during his secret trip to America to study these Civil War battlefields. And there people have seen the ghost of Rommel, as well as smell the scent of pipe, which apparently he smoked when he was there. So I thought that.
But if he didn't die there, why would you think that of all the places in the world, Rommel would be seen in those places?
Absolutely. I am not sure. Now, I have, you know, I have written other books where ghosts appear in different places, like Elvis, Mama Cass is in a couple different places. And so maybe that's it. It just seems very weird to me that if this is, that this German general, the only place you can really see the ghost of or run into the ghost of a German general is in the United States.
It makes you wonder if maybe there's something that was brought back that somebody may have had of his that would have an energy to it. It seems too weird that he would still be haunting the spots where he didn't die and there was no traumatic experience for him.
It could be. I put that in there just sort of to let other people debate whether they think that's true or not. I know that the tactics of a lot of Rommel's tactics seem to be based on Civil War generals, people like Nathan Bedford Forrest and Jeb Stuart. So, you know, I don't know whether he would need to actually come visit the fields. And there, I've run into this story a couple other places, never in any solid history books, but a lot of historical fiction, I think, kind of use this motif of Rommel coming to visit the United States. You know, there's a little bit of kind of bizarre patriotism involved in this because a lot of Americans can't figure out how someone like Rommel would gain this knowledge, you know, because the United States is really such a military power. How would this guy get this type of information? I think that might be a little bit behind it, too. So that was by far the strangest. I think the other one that bowled me over was, and apparently Winston Churchill was out about this. And I should back this up and say some of the stories I talk about are ghosts of famous figures. In this case, this is a famous figure who sees the ghost of a famous figure. But this is the story that Winston Churchill was on one of his many trips to the United States during the war. He stayed in what's now called the Lincoln Bedroom. And he was coming. I hate to drop this image off on you and the rest of the folks here, but he was coming out of the bathroom naked, and he looked at the mantle, and there was Abraham Lincoln, or the ghost of Abraham Lincoln, who turns to Winston Churchill and gives somewhat of a smile as Winston Churchill said, he told the president, "I see you've caught me in a disadvantage." And with that, the president, the 16th president of the United States, faded away. So that was my other favorite story that I really didn't expect to uncover.
Yeah, that's a little bizarre, but I've heard the story. I just didn't realize that Winston Churchill was nude at the time.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's a part I think people would probably want to hide.
You know, doing a little bit of research, and I'm sure, you know, I've got some friends out there that are big into the remote viewing. I've seen that there was some, it appears that there was some forms of remote viewing done during World War II, or perhaps attempted. Wouldn't it be interesting to find out that Rommel didn't actually come here, but was part of those trials? And because they were, I will give the Nazis this, they were forward thinking when it came to psychic phenomena, thinking outside the box to try to get an advantage. What if those visions, and the reason people can't find any documented proof that Rommel was there, is because physically he never did make it to the United States, but in a sense of remote viewing or projection, he was there to see these things. And that's why we see this kind of echo, this image of this astral form, which of course wouldn't be bound by any specific time.
That's a great theory, and one I didn't think about, but I mean, that's about as good a theory as any of the other ones that come around this Rommel sighting.
Well, for $11.22, you can put it in the next edition of the book. I'll just sell that whole aspect to you.
I will do that gladly.
that's remarkable. So you've got these tales. You've also got, during World War II, if I'm correct, I mean, even on the United States side, there was some weird stuff. Wasn't General Patton supposedly reincarnated and was getting information and things that were helping him during World War II as well?
Well, that's really interesting you brought that up, because when you were discussing the lady who is the reincarnation of Anne Frank, I started to think about Patton, and I'm not even sure if I included this in the book. I can't remember, but General Patton believed, and one of the facts I came across is General Patton, and I think I actually got this from his diary, that he really believed that he was a reincarnated, I think, Carthaginian soldier involved in the Punic Wars. And there's one story, and I think it's in the movie, about Patton, where he seems to have a preternatural ability to find an ancient battlefield while he was in North Africa. So, you know, he had a deep connection to these supernatural, to the occult, I think maybe more so than even Hitler. But that's another point. But also, he, in World War One, he was in part of a group that was charging German lines. And at one point, I think he fell down. He might have even been wounded. And he starts to maybe panic. It almost sounds like he's going to panic. And he saw the ghosts or the apparitions or a vision of those ancestors that I talked about earlier, urging and beseeching him on to the line. And he sort of heroically got up and charged and lived to tell about it. So he had several of these supernatural run-ins. Another thing that I discovered, which I didn't know about, was that his daughters afterwards had, I guess they would almost be like post-death encounters with their father. I believe one daughter got a phone call from General Patton after he died in a Jeep accident. And another, I think, said that she saw an apparition of her father appear at her bedside. So there was another fascinating part for me was to find these, when you think about Patton, you think of this tough, you know, blood and guts guy, but he actually had this spiritual, poetic side to him that, you know, even his daughter sensed.
That's a remarkable story. All right, Matthew Swain, I know time's ticking away and you've got to get back to the real world here, but let's hear some of your other favorite stories that you put together in this book. And I know there's a lot that you cover. Aleister Crowley, as a matter of fact, I think that's an important bit of the story. As we're talking about strange magical battles and people's fascination with the occult, Aleister Crowley is rumored to have had a hand and was actually called upon to help during World War II. Were you able to find anything to actually corroborate this story?
Well, I found a lot of sources that corroborated both sides of what we know and what we think we know. But, I mean, how could I forget the Aleister Crowley story when we talked about the magical influences of World War II? Because, again, you have a guy who is, you know, a renowned, completely out of the closet occultist, libertine, and then you have Ian Fleming, who, you know, goes on to write James Bond books, partnering together in what some say was a magical counter to the Nazis' considerable dark magic powers. And this story really fascinated me because and I had known some of the ins and outs of it, but according to some sources, Crowley helped Ian Fleming create astrological charts that would give Rudolf Hess, and I, you know, Rudolf Hess, Hitler's right-hand man, I believe he was the third technically in power at that time, to get him to leave Germany and to defect, quote unquote, defect. But Crowley said that he did more than that. He talked to Ian Fleming, who gave him this idea. And Crowley said that he performed a spell that actually created, forced Rudolf Hess to take on this peace mission. And of course, as I mentioned before, that this mission was seen as a huge debacle for Hitler and Hitler's regime. So that was one story that came up about Crowley. Now, I've heard two different versions. I heard that definitely historically this did seem to happen, that Crowley and Ian Fleming did meet and talk about some of these things or discuss them via mail. But what we don't have is an actual idea of whether there was this idea that there was going to be kind of an occult. Fleming and the rest of the British Secret Service did seem to think that the weak link in the Nazi establishment was their over-reliance on things like Nostradamus and astrological charts and things like that. And they thought maybe they could manipulate that. So there's one school that says that's probably what happened. Maybe Crowley just gave him Fleming and the British Secret Service some help, you know, massaging those messages, as it were. The other side really says that Crowley performed magic, and there's an equally strong opinion about how he did things like that, how he used occult forces. And the other story that crops up about Crowley is that the famous V for Victory sign that Churchill was known of kind of flashing all the time. I think it's more like our peace symbol. According to Crowley, that was based on his book where he talks about various hand signs and gestures, mudras, if you will. And that was the real reason he was giving this V for Victory sign. It was an occult hand signal to ward off evil. The other thing I found out, by the by, is that Goldfinger from James Bond fame might have been inspired by Aleister Crowley. So kind of
no
an interesting
kidding.
Guy. Yeah, that's and if you look at it, you can kind of see it. I can kind of see the physical resemblances there.
What Now, did he have something to do with the Cone of Silence? Are you familiar with that? Or the Cone of Power, I think it was called?
I don't think he was involved in that. I believe that was more Gerald Gardner.
Okay.
And that was that meeting in the New Forest where they brought in a group of Wiccans, witches, wizards to create this Cone of Power to take on the Nazi forces. That was all part of this magical attack on Nazi Germany.
All right. Now, talking about some of the ghost stories, I want to get into that and the idea, too, with the ghost planes and ships mm-hmm. and some of the other weird, fascinating stories with that. Where do you want to start with that? Let's start with the air. I mean, that's something we rarely hear about, the ghosts of the air. What have you got for us on that?
Yeah, this is a family legend, and I don't know why I'm bringing it up now, but my mother and father, who both passed away, so now I can tell the story. When I was young, they claimed, I remember them telling me the story, and my mother continually tells this story about how they went out for a walk on a foggy morning, and it was really a dense fog, and they looked up the sky, and I don't think it was more than a couple hundred, maybe 100 feet off the ground, really at house roof level. They saw a huge plane. The light was, they could even make out that the light was on inside of the cockpit, and it flew over and just kind of disappeared into the fog. It didn't make any noise or anything like that. So that's always been Mom's ghost plane story that she used to love to tell. So when I was writing this book, I just thought, well, let's see if there are any ghost planes. And I figured England was basically an aircraft carrier for the war effort. And sure enough, there is especially one area called the Dark Peak. And it's in the northern section of the UK. It's really near a nice, calm sounding town or area called Derbyshire. But apparently the skies above Derbyshire are anything but pastoral. There were several plane crashes there, I think something like 50. In World War II, it was very active. It was called the Bermuda Triangle of England's aviation history or industry. And since then, there have been these what they call ghost plane flaps. There was one in 1985 in this area. And really, dozens of people reported seeing this huge four-engine bomber flying over the area there at real low levels. Some of these people were very good witnesses. You know, as a former journalist, you're looking for people corroborating witnesses, and they definitely had that. It was so close that a few of the witnesses could make out kind of what type it was. And there were a few witnesses, at least one that I recall of, that was living during World War II, knew the basic shapes of these planes, was familiar with planes. And this one witness ID'd it as a Lancaster bomber. And so, of course, you know, you have a lot of skeptics and cynics getting involved, and they try to find out whether there's an air show nearby, that maybe this was on the flight path. They couldn't find that. Could it be, you know, a movie being filmed? Any of those possibilities. But it does seem legitimately like some people saw a huge plane flying over. Some of the witnesses said it had no sound. Some of them said it had this kind of lumbering propeller sound. I also looked into it, and really the only maybe rational explanation I could find is something like a C-130. But, you know, if a witness knows the World War II planes, they would obviously see some definite physical characteristics that are different between those two planes. So to me, it's a mystery. It's a cool mystery. And England is kind of full of these ghost planes. There just really have been dozens. There was another one kind of near the Dark Peak area. And in this case, there was someone who was actually on a crew of a British in World War II, was on an air crew at the time and worked at an airfield. And he claimed that it was definitely either a Lancaster or a B-24 that flew, that he saw. So that was, I think, in the early 2000s. So these things are pretty recent, for sure.
Unbelievable. And in talking about the strange aerial phenomena, if we don't mention it, I know people will go and lose their mind, but there was a lot of UFO activity seen during World War II. The Foo Fighters, right? There were people that were to watch and try to engage these craft. Now, what can you tell us about that? I mean, again, I've heard a lot of it is you know, maybe been blown out of proportion. But were you able to find any real corroborative information?
Well, so I really did. I added a section on that because, as you mentioned, people would probably show up at my porch with pitchforks and torches if I didn't. But the UFO phenomena really kind of starts World War II. And again, for me, I look at corroborating witnesses who have expertise. And as I point out in the book, there is nobody that knows aircraft profiles like especially an airman at that time, a bomber pilot or a fighter pilot, because their life depends on seeing these planes, recognizing whether they're friend or foe within fractions of a second. So they know the profiles, they know how these planes can perform, they know their capabilities and their characteristics. And I probably only used a few of these stories in the book, but just really dozens of stories cropped up, especially there was the night fighter squadron had really harrowing encounters with these strange objects that appeared sometimes at their wingside. And then there were formations of bombers, and these pilots claimed that these strange lights maneuvered in and out of the formation with such skills, such adroitness that they didn't think that any plane at that time would correspond to that type of flight characteristics. The other thing that, you know, I included in this was a story that took place shortly after the Normandy invasion, and it was a group of officers who were on the beach or near the beach, and they saw a light flying overhead that didn't seem to correspond to anything they've seen before. None of the aircraft looked like that flying overhead on their missions into Europe. And they initially thought maybe it was, a German missile, maybe a V1 or a V2, something like that. But it was definitely going the wrong direction. So that didn't make any sense. That was one of the newer ones that I found. In the United States, you could really classify the Battle of Los Angeles as a UFO sighting. And if anyone doesn't know what the Battle of Los Angeles is, it was a incident that occurred in February right after Pearl Harbor, so 1942. And people's gun crews started firing in the air. There was chaos. Was it the movie 1941? John Belushi was right. was based right. on this. And so a lot of the military quickly classified this as a case of war jitters. They said those crews mistook maybe a friendly aircraft or a cloud formation for a enemy fighter, and they started shooting at it, and you know, everyone's on edge, so it just filtered up and down the lines. However, some really good witnesses have stepped forward and said that's not what they saw. One of the most impressive testimonies that I read that I included in the book was a man named C. Scott Littleton. He's dead now, but he was a professor of anthropology at Occidental College in Los Angeles. And he was just a kid at the time, but he saw this object that I think maybe some of you, if you Google it, you could find pictures of this huge object that seems to be frozen in these spotlights that were focused, you know, on anti-aircraft guns. He really saw it up close. It flew over his head as they were trying to seek shelter. And he was so close to the action. I think I recall him writing that he could remember, he could hear the clink of some of the shells falling from the sky and the shrapnel falling from the sky. So that's another interesting one.
Tim, I believe, if I'm correct, that's one of the stories that we did in I think, our first year with Theater of the Mind, right? We did one of the stories of the battle over Los Angeles. What we'll try to do, I'll see if I can have Tim dig that up and play that aspect at the end of today's show, kind of a bonus replay of one of our Theater of the Minds. It's a little bit longer, but it is a really crazy story, and I'd encourage you guys to take a listen and just tune in for it. It'll be a cool little addition to today's program. So you kind of get two Theater of the Minds, both strangely UFO related, but you'll check that out. Let's wrap up with a couple of ghost stories, your favorite and most mind-blowing ghost stories, if you don't mind, Matt.
Sure. Well, I think some of the, as a collection of ghost stories, I think the most fascinating, kind of the most mind-blowing are the stories of all the haunted ships that are out there, haunted World War II ships that are out there. And I discovered, you know, I think it's one of those things that I think is a great story to tell, is that after the war, we had all these wonderful ships that no longer had a purpose, you know, these massive carriers and massive battleships. And what people did is they decided this would be a great living history monument, a museum. And so they brought a lot of them back. And when they did, they brought a lot of ghost stories. So I know I didn't even touch on a lot of the ghost stories out there from a lot of different ships that are being used in this way. But, you know, the USS Lexington, the Blue Ghost, as they call it, was haunted. There's a ghost attached to the USS Lexington. One of my favorites is the USS North Carolina. And it's so haunted that one of the teams that I worked with to get their stories, Port City Paranormal, basically made a career out of studying the goings on there. And the story about North Carolina that's really haunting, I guess that's a poor term for this. I guess a really evocative story is that there was a torpedo attack on the North Carolina, and they had to close off sections of the ship. Because it was taking in water, and they had to close it off so that it could remain afloat while they repaired the damage. Unfortunately, there were people in those sections, and what a terrible, horrific decision that would be to close those off so that the rest of the ship could right itself. But anyways, these investigators kind of tell me that there are ghosts of those victims that were stuck in that flooded section. And another watchman wrote a book actually about his experiences on that as being a night watchman on that ship. And he has some really kind of freaky stories to tell. The USS Arizona, as you mentioned, there are several stories attached to that. There's some really interesting photographic evidence. People have taken, one lady in particular took a picture of the waves, and you could see faces in it. Now, and I recognize that human beings are pattern-seeking animals. We want to see patterns. We want to see faces in the clouds and in the ocean waves. But a lot of people look into that and are deeply moved by what they see. And I think finally, for me, the USS the Sullivans is another one of those evocative stories. And if you know the story about the Sullivan boys, essentially this was the story that Saving Private Ryan was based on. But they were five brothers from Iowa. They insisted on serving on the same ship. So there was Joseph, Francis, Albert, Madison, and George, who were serving on the USS Juno. And it was sunk by a Japanese submarine. All of the brothers, along with, I think, 600 other sailors, died. And it was just such a catastrophic event. And it was really bad PR for the American war effort. So they the military dedicated a book. Dedicated a boat called the USS the Sullivans in their honor, that obviously nothing happened to it because it came back, and now it's a museum in the Buffalo Naval Park. But there have been several ghost stories attached to that, and a lot of paranormal groups have investigated that. So back to your point, these brothers were never on this ship, yet there are still ghost stories attached to it. So it's kind of interesting. So those were some of the highlights for me when I was doing the section on the naval haunted stories.
Well, you know, as we're talking about naval haunted stories in the Battle of L.A., which actually took place over Long Beach, right? Their station now, since 1967, is the Queen Mary, which was used and referred to as the Gray Ghost during World War II.
Right.
And they suffered some casualties during that time when they struck another ship and lost a bunch of people. Mm. That ship is wildly haunted and reportedly haunted. And they play it up quite a bit. So you can go actually tour and stay aboard the ship. And we've done that. We did that for 5-6 years. And we had strange phenomena happen. Everything from TVs going on by themselves, water faucets and toilets flushing and things in your room when you're the only one there, to full on apparitions being seen, voices. We've heard voices. We've had strange communication. So the Queen Mary is also kind of a remnant of the World War II era haunted ships that's still out there.
Well, I probably owe you another $11 because I should have used that one. Maybe I'll do that for the sequel.
Excellent. Yes. Just let me know. 1122. I'll just keep ticking them up there. Okay. I think we're up to 2244 right now. Not that I'm counting, but, all right, let's, as we go out, was there any one of the ghost stories that you really, you know, personal ghost stories or such that you really were kind of impacted by when you did this book?
I actually was moved very deeply by the stories, especially the stories in the South Pacific, and in particular, this one ghost story in Okinawa. And the history behind Okinawa is that the Japanese kind of figured that if they would lose Okinawa, the Americans would build a base, an air base. The air base would be within striking distance easily of homeland Japan, Tokyo, places like that. So they knew how pivotal that island was to this American strategy of island hopping. So they had prepped the civilians in that area by telling them these horrific stories of American atrocities that the American soldiers would come in and rape and kill and torture. And I'm sure what they expected the civilians to do was to attack the Americans as soon as they saw them. But apparently the level of fright was so much that when the Americans did arrive and did land and did start seizing control, many civilians, and I would hazard to guess maybe hundreds, would run through this field and leap off the cliffs and essentially kill themselves. And there was a story, now I believe there's a peace museum there. And one couple said they were walking across the field that these civilians probably would have ran across to their demise. And they felt and heard a stampede of footsteps coming behind them, and then felt a whoosh of air, like something passed them, and then heard, you know, screams of people falling off the cliff. So I found that very, you know, sad, but somewhat frames just the tragedy and the terror of war. And there were many of those. There's another haunting tale, again, haunting, that happened in Iwo Jima, that some of the civilians who live there now hear knocking at their door. And this was, I think, written up in a Japanese newspaper. And the one person that it happened to just opened up the door and said, "I'm leaving for the homeland tomorrow. Just come on board." And he really believed that these ghosts were trying to get back to the homeland, the Japanese homeland, that they were stuck on Iwo Jima. Just, you know, kind of heartrending stuff that you come across in some of these. A lot different from what I've written about with Jim Morrison's ghost hanging out in a Mexican restaurant bathroom. So, you know, a little different for me.
And that's a hell of an end for him. That's it for today. Haunted World War II, Soldier Spirits, Ghost Planes, Strange Synchronicities. The book will be out officially October 8th. We'll have a link to that. Thank you again for joining us, Matthew. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Been great.
All right. Stay tuned. We've got that special edition from about a year, year and a half ago of the Battle of Los Angeles, Theater of the Mind. It's a longer one, but I think you guys might enjoy it. So stay tuned. That's it for the regular show. Enjoy this bonus Theater of the Mind. We'll be back again with you next week with more of the best in paranormal talk radio, more Beyond the Darkness.
The Battle of Los Angeles by C. Scott Littleton, former professor of anthropology emeritus and former chair of the Department of Anthropology at Occidental College in Los Angeles. I'm a native Californian. I was born in Los Angeles and grew up in Hermosa Beach. And it was an incident during my growing up years that I want to talk about here. The Battle of Los Angeles. The night that a UFO was fired upon by the U.S. repeatedly, with no apparent effect. I was an eyewitness. As 1942 dawned, the war news continued to be bad. In Southern California, and particularly in the beach communities, the threat of invasion was still palpable, if not imminent. And a great many folks, including the military, still expected us to be bombed in the near future. For that reason, the whole of Santa Monica Bay, from Malibu to Palo Verdes, was soon ringed with anti-aircraft batteries and searchlight brigades. The guns banged away almost every night, shooting at targets that were towed across the sky over the ocean by specially designed planes. The targets would be pinpointed by the searchlight beams, which also illuminated the exploding shells. It was a grand show that usually lasted about a half an hour and rarely continued after 10 p.m., out of respect for the local populace. At first, we'd watch the action with great fascination, but after a few nights in early January, the noise of the guns and the exploding shells soon became routine, as predictable as the sound of the waves in the winter. Most people learned to sleep through the cacophony with few problems. It gave us a sense of security. Our brave anti-aircraft gunners would quickly save us from any hostile attempt to penetrate our airspace, let alone bomb us. Meanwhile, the government had also organized the Civil Defense Program, the core of which was a cadre of dedicated air raid wardens. My father joined up shortly before the end of the year and was soon assigned to monitor the Strand between 27th Street and 22nd Street in case of an air attack. However, he was also expected to enforce the blackout during air raid drills, which we soon began to have regularly, as well as the so-called dim out, which required those of us who lived in houses facing the water, both on the Strand and on the hill that rose behind Hermosa Avenue, to keep their front blinds drawn from dusk till dawn. The idea was to reduce the glare against which a tanker or merchant ship would be silhouetted and thus become an easy target as a Japanese submarine might be out there. This meant that he went on a patrol almost every evening shortly after sundown. In the early morning hours of February 25th, blackout drills, which were always announced well in advance, at least to the wardens, usually went pretty well. My father would get the word, and then an hour later, the siren would sound. He'd put on his helmet, grab his flashlight, and start patrolling the Strand. But when the real thing came along, the system totally collapsed. The early evening of February 24th, 1942 was unremarkable. The guns fired a few practice rounds and then fell silent well before 10 p.m. I remember going to bed shortly thereafter, reading for a few minutes by the light of a small flashlight I kept hidden under my bed, and then falling asleep. Around 3:15 a.m., I awoke to the sound of what I initially assumed was distant thunder. But as I came fully awake, I realized that the guns were firing again. At first, I thought they were simply doing another drill, though it seemed awfully late. Moreover, there was something about the rate and intensity of the bombardment that just didn't seem right, especially after I glanced at my clock. My small bedroom was directly over the front door and faced south. Thus, my view of the ocean was oblique. However, what I could see of the sky as I lay there was filled with blinding searchlight beams and the bright flashes of exploding rounds. I was, of course, thoroughly familiar with both, thanks to the target practice I'd witnessed. But heretofore, the searchlights and explosions had always been well out over the ocean and, for the most part, invisible from my bedroom windows when I was in bed. This time,
everything seemed much closer. I soon heard my parents talking in the hall and poked my head out. My father looked worried and said it didn't make sense. He tried to get through by phone to the Civil Defense Headquarters, but nobody answered. We later learned that the alert had been called at 2:25 a.m., but nobody bothered to get the word out to the local air raid wardens. So he put on his gear and went outside to see what was happening. Somewhere in the distance, an air raid siren was wailing. Dad returned looking even more worried and told my mother to get me to the bomb shelter ASAP. I was equal parts scared and excited and desperately wanted to know what was going on. By this time, my father was back on the street and belatedly over the continuing gunfire, the local siren finally sounded. My mother and I were dying to slip outside and watch the real thing. After about 10 minutes in such cramped quarters, she was ready to brave a Japanese bomb or two. Our first thought was that an enemy squadron was overhead as we began to hear the roar of aircraft engines over the din of the barrage, but they were almost certainly our own pursuit planes. When she exited the basement through the door that led to the beach, I followed close behind. Although my mother was apprehensive about my safety, at the same time she understood why I desperately wanted to see what was happening, and she elected to let me stay. The two of us stood side by side in front of the house, huddling together in the chill of night air and staring up into the sky. The planes we'd heard were not in sight, but what captured our rapt attention was a silvery, lozenge-shaped bug, as my mother later described it, whose bright glow was clear visible in the searchlight beams that pinpointed it. Although it was clear moonlit night, no other details were visible, despite the fact that when we first saw it, the object was hanging, motionless, almost directly overhead. Its altitude had to estimate, especially after all these years, but I'd guess it was somewhere between 4,000 and 8,000 feet. This may explain why we didn't see the orange glow reported by several eyewitnesses in Santa Monica and Culver City, where the object was apparently much lower. As we watched it, our mouth open, the object, apparently none the worse for the plethora of 3-inch, 12.8-pound anti-aircraft rounds fired at it, began to move slowly to the southeast over Redondo Beach, where we lost sight of it. Either our gunners were woefully inept, despite all the practice they'd had in recent weeks, or it was invulnerable to attack. Years later, I read that approximately 1,400 rounds were fired at that object that evening. Could the Japanese have come up with some secret weapon that actually deflected flak? The thought was terrifying. But whatever it was, it certainly wasn't going aggressively. Rather, it simply made its stately way across the sky. Shortly before we lost sight of it, the object subsequently appeared over San Pedro and Long Beach before finally disappearing over the ocean, somewhere off southern Orange County. We again heard the unmistakable sound of aircraft engines. By that time, the bombardment was largely petered out, and a flight of Army interceptors, probably based at Mines Field, today the site of the Los Angeles International Airport, approached from the northeast and buzzed off to the southeast, apparently chasing the object. It was now 4 a.m. Precisely how long we stood there is anybody's guess, though I suspect the whole episode, from our leaving the shelter to meeting my father as he returned to house for good, lasted about 25 minutes. As I recall, the firing ceased altogether shortly thereafter. The all-clear didn't actually sound until 7:30 a.m., but nobody went to bed that night. The next morning, the Los Angeles Examiner came out with a banner headline, "Air Battle Rages Over Los Angeles," followed by "One Plane Reported Down by Vermont Avenue by Gunfire in Smaller Type." The story, which I still have safely tucked away, claimed to be based on a report from the LAPD's 77th Street Division. At the time, this appeared to be pure fantasy, a prime example of the yellow journalism so characteristic of Hart newspapers in those days, as no bombs fell, nor apparently was any plane, Japanese or otherwise, shot down anywhere in Southern California that night. However, in retrospect, both the cops and the Examiner seem to have been right about one thing. A plane does appear to have crashed, or perhaps crash-landed, on South Vermont Avenue near 180th Street that morning. And from eyewitness accounts, collected years later, it was almost certainly one of ours, forced down either by the object itself or by friendly fire. There were only a handful of civilian casualties. According to the Times, 5 people died from heart attacks and automobile accidents, and there were a few injuries from falling shrapnel. There was also some minor property damage, again, mostly from shrapnel. Indeed, the beach was littered with the stuff. At the time, it was widely assumed that a high-altitude, carrier-based Japanese observation plane had flown over the Los Angeles basin, and that it was perhaps the harbinger of another Pearl Harbor attack, this time on the West Coast. Later on, we began to suspect that perhaps one of our own military planes was the culprit. But no 1942 vintage planes, military or civilian, Japanese or American, were capable of standing still in the air. The one thing we did learn after the war was that neither the Japanese nor our own people seemed to have any record of one of their aircraft straying over the Los Angeles basin that morning. Even the presence of our pursuit planes, which was absolutely certain, has been steadfastly denied by the government. Of course, all concerned could be lying, though the probability of such a lie persisting for over 60 years is remote, unless it involves something so profoundly disconcerting that it had to be shrouded in secrecy from then on. So, what precisely did we witness on February 25th, 1942? In recent decades, several ufologists, the people who study the UFO phenomenon, have suggested that it might have been an extraterrestrial craft. If that assessment is correct, it certainly precipitated one of the largest mass UFO sightings in history, as it involved well over 1 million people. Only the sightings over Mexico City in the late 1990s exceeded it in terms of the total number of eyewitnesses. It also would account for the cloak of secrecy that has surrounded the episode for the past 6.5 decades. To be sure, no one suggested this idea in February 1942. It wasn't until 5 years later, after civilian pilot Kenneth Arnold's landmark sighting of 9 flying saucers over Mount Rainier in June of 1947, which was followed almost immediately by what now appears to have been the crash of a UFO near Roswell, New Mexico, that the notion that spacecraft from other planets might be invading our skies became widespread. But in retrospect, the Battle of Los Angeles has all the earmarks of a classic UFO event. Several residents who lived just north of Baldwin Hills saw it clearly. From their reports, it was round with a slight hump in the middle. A woman named Katie, who observed it from the window of her home, stated that it was huge, elliptical in shape, and suffused with a brilliant orange glow. Meanwhile, the anti-aircraft barrage had already begun, and the searchlights were following it steadily. A Los Angeles Times reporter living in San Gabriel Valley jumped in his car and began driving west as rapidly as he could toward the sound of guns, arriving at the northern edge of the Baldwin Hills, in the vicinity of Jefferson and La Cienega, in time to photograph the object as it rose over the ridgeline. The image, which was published in the Times on February 26th, is the only clear picture of the craft. You can see it's caught in the beams of several searchlights and is surrounded by white dots created by exploding shells. From the width of the light beams at the point they reached the object, plus the knowledge that at least one of them came from a searchlight battery in Manhattan Beach some 10 miles away, the others appear to have come from Inglewood or El Segundo, it is suggested that it was perhaps as large as 800 feet in diameter, and I agree with this estimate. After crossing the Baldwin Hills, it appears to have veered westward toward El Segundo and the aircraft plants. When it reached the coast, it rose to a higher altitude and slowly followed the edge of the ocean, due south to the point where we first saw it. Then it veered southwestward over Redondo Beach, blithely ignoring everything we were throwing at it, and soon disappeared from sight behind the town's hills. Although there's never been an official explanation of this curious episode, a number of unofficial explanations have been advanced over the years, ranging from an off-course private pilot, although civilian aircraft had been banned from the skies of Southern California shortly after the war began, to a barrage balloon that escaped its tether over one of the El Segundo aircraft plants, an errant Army weather balloon, and even a flock of seabirds. However, in light of what we now know about the UFO phenomenon, I strongly suspect that the most efficient explanation, the one that fits all the known facts most completely, is that it was an alien craft. Although my parents and I were only able to tell that it was bright and bug-like, the aforementioned Times photo, as well as other eyewitness accounts from Santa Monica and Culver City, indicate that it was a huge, saucer-shaped object that had, in addition to an orange glow, a protuberance of some sort of its dorsal or upper side. This, of course, jibes closely with literally thousands of eyewitness accounts of UFOs in this country and elsewhere that have come to light in the course of the last six decades.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No